is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Folks, this is Screen Watching. It's our weekly deep dive into the things we watch on the screens. My name, Dan Barrett, joined, as always, by Master Simon Foster.
Master and Commander. How are you, Dan Barrett? I am very well, thank you for asking. Hello, Screen Watchers. Good to be back in your ear holes with another week of Screen Watching. Well, that sounded very FM radio, didn't it? I'm getting very FM radio in the way I talk.
Look, I'm not sure about that, but I certainly know that being in ear holes is one of the better holes to be in. In this scenario, not impugning people's personal interests and doing stuff
Apple
and
rating, yeah.
Inputting and outputting and whatnot. Simon Foster, we're here to talk about the movies and the TV shows we watch this week. Look, I don't know about you, but when I go packing, like when I go on holidays, I like to pack a bag properly. Okay, sure. I do some very strong inputting of clothes and squish them down and push them around and make sure that I can fit all the things in there. Strong packing.
Yep.
And as I think about what we're doing here on the podcast, I think about my skills with a suitcase, and it's appropriate because we've got a very packed show.
Nice segue. See, that's why you do what you do. You're very good at that sort of stuff. And notably, I'm going away. I'm packing for a weekend away with Ronnie the Cocker Spaniel this weekend, the fur friend, the forever fur friend of your friend and mine, Mr. Ben and Miss Sophie. So excellent. Excellent segue. Yeah. Very relevant.
Yeah, I've not met that dog before, but, you know, I trust that it exists and I've seen it in a photo, I'm sure.
It's a thoroughly objectionable animal, but I'm looking after it.
We've got some important business to get through.
I do apologize.
Okay. So before we get into the business of the podcast, can I just quickly address some business of the podcast? Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, sure. Knock yourself out. You're the producer. Go for it. Say what you want.
Yeah. Look. Okay. So myself and Simon, we had a little meeting a couple of days ago, about a week ago. Mm. It's been, a week since the last podcast.
Yep.
We're doing something different with the podcast. If you listen to this podcast, nothing changes. Not a single thing. It's still going to be the same low quality, low engagement, low energy podcast you've always received. So nothing there is going to change. The podcast is available everywhere you get a podcast. If you've got Spotify, you can press the button and you can see the video feed and you can see myself and Simon talking into microphones with fairly average looking podcast scenario backgrounds behind us.
Very average.
That will all continue, as always. The handsomest podcast in podcasting, obviously, but beyond that, just all that just continues on. But we're playing around in YouTube space a little bit more. That is not going to impact the podcast, but if you are someone who's on YouTube, which, you know, maybe prefer to be watching this on YouTube than via podcast, I think the podcast is the more superior experience, but I do know that people like their YouTube and are listening to podcasts more and more through that. You're going to find that we've changed it up. We used to just upload this entire video podcast, as you'd see on Spotify, just onto YouTube. That's not really entirely that YouTube friendly, okay? And, you know, basically what we wanted to do is we've got all the segments on the show anyway. So now each of those segments is just available on their own in various releases across YouTube. We'll get you to talk about the release schedule in just a moment. But I do want to say that if you like this podcast as it currently stands, and I got a very nice email from one of our listeners the other day expressing such a thing, that's not going to change. And if anything, the podcast listeners are going to get a little bit more than your average YouTube viewer as well, because there's a couple of segments and conversational pieces we probably won't be uploading as video. Video segments will be shorter on YouTube, but the proper podcast continues on and we're right here.
Yeah, it's. I think it's a great idea. Dan came to me with that idea, and I think you were right too. It looks good in the shorter form. We'll have a review segment. Those who've been to the YouTube channel last week will see that reviews is now standalone. We're going to put our intermission as a standalone segment. We may or may not. We're sort of toying with the idea of having what else have you been watching as a standalone segment. And we've got our quizzes. The fun part of the show at the end there are also. So they're going to be four new channels exclusive to our YouTube channel. And you get to watch it in smaller bites, smaller sound grabs, which is the way you YouTubers like to do. And we've actually built up a bit of a following. We've during the week, we topped a few hundred subscribers, which isn't too bad for having sort of no marketing budget. We're getting the bit of the word out there. And our interviews do very well. I meet the filmmakers. There's also a Meet the Filmmakers and Actors on Acting channel on the YouTube channel. So thank you for your support of the YouTube channel. Get on over there if you want little bite-sized grabs of what we do here in the podcast and get to look at our beautiful faces as well. Plus, can I just say, I am quite the master at Canva, and the little sort of title cards that I do for our YouTube channel and our Facebook page, they really are just some of the best things on the internet.
Okay. Don't really know how to come off the back of that Canva conversation, but I will say that Simon does run that Actors on Acting channel. I'm actually in the process of launching another channel that will live on the YouTube channel, and it's actually going to be Actors on Welding, which...
Oh, good.
Yeah. You know, there's some very honest conversations there.
Actors with a trade. That's a good thing to do. You could do Harrison Ford. He was a carpenter once. Harrison Ford was a carpenter, famously.
Yeah, he's not returning my calls. Anyway, Simon, we've dilly-dallied enough. Let us dive right into a couple of reviews.
It stinks.
Simon, it is a very big week for reviews. This week, you're going to take a look at Civil War, the brand new movie hitting the cinema screens. You're also going to take a look at the late-night horror film Late Night with the Devil. I've got a couple of TV shows, The Sympathizer, which is a new HBO joint, and Franklin, which has Michael Douglas wearing some very fancy prosthetics, and that's debuting on Apple TV+. Look, there's some exciting stuff here, but do you want to kick us off? Let's maybe start with Civil War, and let's just throw to a clip.
All across America, critics are raving about the movie event of the year.
It is American, 100%. That's what I'm talking about.
Cool.
Going to D.C.
Are you serious? The United States are vaporized. They shoot us on sight in the Capitol.
I've never been scared like that before, and I've never felt more alive.
Maybe this is the first film to come out in 2024 that's got everybody really buzzing about its point of view, and that's not often a thing that we have to deal with when we're talking about Hollywood films. But Alex Garland's new film, you know him from Ex Machina. Alex Garland did 28 Days Later, I should say. He's made some terrific films over the years. In his latest one, he imagines a near future in which California and parts of California and the state of Texas have combined to create an armed force that is then taking on the fascistic president of the United States and the world that he runs. So while it's a little bit of a long bow to pull to say that it's taken from today's headlines, it certainly uses the current state of politics in the US and the fragility of democracy as a backdrop to the story of four journalists. This is more a film that has links to other movies like The Year of Living Dangerously or Salvador, the Oliver Stone film that looks at journalists embedded in a war zone. And that war zone happens to be the American mainland. Kirsten Dunst is out front of this group of four as the sort of the hardened combat journalist. She takes on board the young Kaylee Spanny, who, you know what, I saw her in Priscilla, but that movie was such a blank slate in terms of what it gave her to do. I don't remember her face, and that's a terrible thing to say. Whereas in Civil War, Kaylee has this incredibly warm innocence that you start to see crumble as the film goes on. And it's one of the great young actor performances that I've seen in recent years, under the tutelage of Kirsten Dunst, who gives maybe her most grown up and most richly textured performance as the veteran photojournalist going into a war zone. So it is essentially a road movie where these four journalists are trying to get from one point in the middle of the country down through West Virginia and then into Washington, D.C. to interview the crumbling president played by Nick Offerman, who we only see at the start of the film and then at the end, but he is obviously the focus of their main goal. And on this road trip through America, they meet the different types of Americans who have been divided by the war, who are ignoring the war, trying to live on as if there was nothing going on, and those that are completely energized in their points of view. That is exhibited in one of the most chilling scenes I've seen in a long time by Jesse Plemons as a radical militia type who manages to get the four journalists alone and horrible things happen. So you have a war zone movie. What makes it so convincing as a war zone movie is that the fairly recent footage of the January 6th insurrection and the very recent footage coming out of places like Ukraine, where we see modern buildings and modern metropolises being reduced to waste. In Civil War, Alex Garland does that with, you'll see a JCPenney, but it's on fire and has been largely broken down. You'll see a Walmart with exploded helicopters and tanks out the front. So there is very much the images of war that we're used to, but in this very American setting. And what that does is it gives it a sense that this could happen so easily. This could happen in the blink of an eye, given the current political climate. Having said that, Civil War isn't particularly a politically driven film. It doesn't take a specific stance as to who's right and who's wrong in this Civil War. Clearly there's villains and clearly there's heroes, but it's very much a war placed in the American heartland and mainland, just as it would be in any other part of the world. The sensation is just how easy this could happen. We don't expect California and Texas to join up in a war, but as it's positioned in this film, they do. And the politics of that are touched on, and you sort of can understand why it's happened, but really, this is really the story of the four journalists. It softly, softly treads through the actual combat of a civil war in the first half of the film, but the last 30 minutes, it unleashes some of the most torrid war action when they finally get to Washington, D.C. that you'll see. I'm not on the payroll, but I did see this at the IMAX theater, and the thumping sound system puts you right in the middle of the war zone and the combat as it happens. So this is a very potent, very powerful film. It's not going to answer any questions about what's wrong with America and its very shaky democracy at the moment, but it is going to tell you that it does sort of get the message across that if we don't do everything we can do to sort out what is wrong, this is where we might end up. And that's a pretty good message in and of itself. So Civil War is in wide cinemas. You might come out of it with your own point of view as to what the film's politics are, and that I guess that will be more about what you take in and how you want to interpret certain scenes and certain characters. But for me, it's just a cracking drama about these four characters, and in that regard, it's an apolitical statement that still packs a real punch.
Yeah, look, I do wonder about this film in that it's 2024. There is a election later in the year in the US that has fairly significant consequence to not just the future of the US, but also, you know, the state of the world generally. Releasing a movie like that this year, like, it just kind of seems like it's fraught with the obvious sort of concerns of audiences not quite really willing to go there for this kind of thing at the moment.
Or the other way, in that they're all terrified, and maybe to work through those fears and deal with what might come about if the worst aspects of American society rear up and get what they want, then this might be exactly what they need to see. So, yeah, whether they respond to it. It's not an easy watch at times because it does show the horrors of war very much in a modern American setting, and that hasn't been seen since the Civil War. The first Civil War, I guess you could say. So to give that kind of texture to the American society is at times really shocking to watch.
Yeah, I kind of feel at times like this, people are after escapism and not necessarily something which is going to help them process that happens after. But anyway, Simon, speaking of the Civil War, this takes us right into what I'm talking about next, Franklin, which is a brand new HBO drama starring one Michael Douglas.
You are a I am
Benjamin Franklin. The Congress has sent me here as a representative of the United States to elicit France in our war against England. America requires men, money, and arms. Without your aid, the United States will end before it has begun.
Look, Simon, obviously this is post-Civil War. Look, I don't know about you, but constant listeners, if you're anything like me, congratulations, you're a really cool guy. But, you know, maybe you're not necessarily cracking open the history books as frequently as other more middle-aged people, maybe. Look, I'm a poor history student, okay? Like, I know enough to get by, but I wouldn't say that I'm deeply sort of interested in some of the intricacies of history. Usually when I get exposed to this, it's by way of the latest HBO drama. Think about, say, maybe John Adams from HBO. I learned probably more there about the founding of the United States than I have from anything else. And it's not like there's a shortage of literature about that. Like, I suddenly, you know, once it's on the screen, I'll watch a bit of that.
Get out, read books.
Yeah. When I was watching the John Adams miniseries on HBO, I hit about the midpoint. And at that stage, they go off to France for a little bit and they bump into one Benjamin Franklin over there. And when I was watching, I was like, oh, I didn't know that Benjamin Franklin spent a couple of years living in France. Apparently, he was there for 8 years. And that 8 years is the focus of this new Apple TV Plus drama called Franklin, starring Michael Douglas as Benjamin Franklin and Noah Jupe as his son. Now, when I was watching this, the one thing that really just hit me from like maybe about 5 minutes in is I kind of feel like I've already seen a version of this and I enjoyed it a lot more, and it was called John Adams. Obviously, you do see John Adams in this miniseries, but that isn't the focus of the series by any chance. And this is certainly a lot lighter on its feet and a little bit more cheeky. There is a sequence in the very first episode where Benjamin Franklin talks about the enjoyment he experienced from a fart. So, look, this is maybe not necessarily the highest of brow productions, but like it's certainly a highbrow, classy production that looks and feels a lot like that John Adams miniseries. Now, I did a little bit of research in that I did the least amount of research I possibly could into this. And the reason why both these things look and feel exactly the same is that they're written by the same guy, Kirk Ellis.
There we go.
Franklin, he's also joined by Howard Carter, but the original John Adams series was just Kirk Ellis flying solo. But also as a producer on this, and amongst the many names, is one Richard Plepler, the former head of HBO. So it's very much him just getting the gang back together to film themselves a bit more American history.
Why can't I remember who played John Adams? Who was it? Well, it was somebody really significant.
It was. It was one Paul Giamatti.
Oh, of course. It was right in his sort of that big Giamatti moment, the sideways and all that sort of stuff. Okay, yes, I do remember it all now. Yep.
No, exactly. And it's not like Michael Douglas is not a, you know, strong lead for a TV series. I mean, he proved that from the streets of San Francisco onwards. You know, we all like Michael Douglas, and like he's perfectly fine here, but this is a series that looks and feels just like that John Adams series, only not quite as good. And it's sort of a little bit of, let's just sort of, you know, replay the hits. It's not really a show that sort of stands on its own where you could watch this and feel as though you're really getting a fulfilling experience out of it, because it just kind of feels like an echo, which is unfortunate.
It's interesting.
I'm just one thought, and then we can just go wherever. I just want to say that if you are interested in history and you enjoy a historical sort of biopic series like this, you're probably going to find a fair bit to like in this. But as someone who is looking at this, one part for entertainment and the other parts just get a little bit of insight as to what's going on, the entertainment side of it just kind of let me down a little bit. It's not quite as energetic as John Adams. The performances aren't really quite as charismatic. And this just kind of feels a little bit flat.
It's interesting that Michael Douglas has been cast, because Benjamin Franklin was known at different times as a bit of a pants man. I think his 8 years in Paris and 8 years in France sort of added to that sort of notion of the man. And Michael Douglas is well and truly known as one of the great Hollywood Lotharios. So there's a little bit of glee in that kind of casting, and might make it interesting to watch as well. So I'm keen to have a look at this. Big Michael Douglas fan. Who does Noah Dupe? I don't know. Why should I know who Noah Dupe is?
It's one of those names that you kind of see around the place. He was exactly one of the sons in. Well, he was in Ford versus Ferrari as one of the kids. He was in A Quiet Place, right. You know, the boy. And A Quiet Place Part 2, also playing the same boy.
Sure. Yeah. All right, okay. Well, that sounds interesting.
He was the kid in The Undoing, which was that miniseries with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant a couple of years ago, which started out really strong and then ended.
Okay, so Franklin is on Apple TV as we speak. If you love your big period dramas, then this could be something to tune into for a bit of a comfort watch, it sounds like.
Yeah. But on a similar note, as a bad student of history, suddenly I found myself deep into the Vietnam War with the new HBO drama called The Sympathizer.
Biracial. Bilingual. That was a synthesis of incompatibilities. So what did I do?
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Get down!
Saigon, 1975. I was a man of two faces.
You are the only one I can trust.
The war was ending.
Yo!
And I awaited my new assignment.
My protege.
Jesus.
So where are we going?
To next harbor on your CIA voyage. America.
Simon, I've talked about being a bad student of history, but frankly, I know a lot about the Vietnam War, and that's largely because I watched Air America, starring Mel Gibson and Robert Downey Jr. from 1990, I think the film was.
That was side of the Vietnam War.
Yes, I practically know everything there is to know about the Vietnam War, or at least I thought I did. And then suddenly I'm confronted with this black comedy series from HBO called The Sympathizer. The Sympathizer, look, this has some pretty major talent behind it. Park Chan-wook is the co-creator of the series and director on it. He is co-writer and director. One of the main people that he's working with here is Don McKellar, who people know as a Canadian actor, but also a screenwriter and director in his own as well. Don McKellar, responsible for one of my favorite movies, this really great film called Last Night. Also made a TV series that's near and dear to my heart called Twitch City, which is about a guy who's a shut-in that just watches a lot of TV. I'll let you guess why I might be a bit interested in that one. But anyway,
doesn't fall too far from the tree there. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so look, I don't quite know how Park Chan-wook and Don McKellar found themselves in each other's orbit, but I'm glad they did, because this is a real highly engaging, very entertaining, as I said, historical black comedy drama. When I went into it, for some reason, I thought it was a half hour, but it's not. The first episode is well and truly in that HBO level 48 minutes drama. The thing, though, is if you read the blurb as to what the show is, it kind of gives away where the series is heading. And when I watched that first episode, I hadn't read anything about the actual subject. I knew that it was in the Vietnam War, but I didn't really know exactly what it was about. And so I actually found myself doing something which I find so rarely when I watch TV, in that I was actually genuinely surprised. I didn't know where things were heading. I couldn't really anticipate what the show is going to be about going forward. I didn't know where we'd be. I didn't know how it was going to be structured. Like, I really am just deep into the mud. And that was one of the enjoyable things about this. So I'm going to give you the first half of the log line behind it, but I'm not going to tell you the second half, because that kind of talks about episode 2 onwards. And I don't really want to do that, because I do think so much of the joy of this is just being thrown into the deep and having to work out who's aligned with who and what and where, and then also what the heck am I even watching? What is this doing? So the line is, the series is based on the story of the captain. It's an unnamed character, but we just call him the captain. He's a North Vietnam plant in the South Vietnam Army. Okay, and that's all I'm going to say there.
Good start. That's a good hook.
While you've got that, there's also, he's got a CIA handler involved as well. And in the first episode, that's played by Robert Downey Jr. There's that Air America linkage right there. Robert Downey Jr. in this. You remember when, what's probably a good example of this? The Batman. Remember that movie that came out a couple of years ago where we had one Colin Farrell?
Point of reference for everything.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. One Colin Farrell dressed up beyond recognition as Oswald Cobblepot, the Penguin. And so people looked at it going, well, you're under all that makeup. Like, why did you hire Colin Farrell to do that? It really could be any actor on that. Or why not just get like a heavy set gentleman who's an actor who would be great playing that role? Like, it seems weird laying them under all that stuff. Robert Downey Jr. is kind of doing the exact same thing in the first episode of this, in that he is fairly unrecognizable until you suddenly realize, wait, that's Robert Downey Jr. because I'm very familiar with this face and these many mannerisms.
Exactly, yes.
When you watch, he's got this crazy hair. He's got some less than perfect Robert Downey Jr. style skin. He's definitely going and hamming it up. He's playing it for every row, the back row, the front row, the row around the block. Like, he is really going for it with this performance there. But, and I'll give this away with it, Robert Downey Jr., he plays several roles throughout the run of the series. You see him there at the beginning, but you're going to see him in other contexts as well as different characters. This is a surprisingly very funny, very human drama. There's a very dramatic moment that happens at the very end. Again, I don't want to say anything because it kind of just leads you to where it's all going.
Okay.
But it's very dramatic, and something happens where I was genuinely, I was excited, but also I was kind of emotionally sort of a little bit hit by what ends up taking place. It's a really absorbing TV show, and I couldn't really recommend this one enough.
Am I rowing this boat alone in that Robert Downey Jr., to me, has lost some of the technique, lost some of the skill that he displayed in his early roles as an actor, and instead has spent the best part of the last decade, and I absolutely include Oppenheimer in this, kind of playing to the back row a bit. What I'm really concerned about the sympathizer is that he gets to play four roles under really heavy makeup, going right to the end of the, going to the nth degree with what he's able to do with these characterizations. And that concerns me because there's a smugness about him, which really suits some characters like Iron Man, like Tony Stark, but it comes across as a little bit overplayed, not very subtle acting in other hands. And it surprises me that I'm saying this because, like, Less Than Zero is Air America, of course, these are his early films, and Chaplin all those years ago that positioned him as a great young actor with a huge future. But the work he's done in the modern Hollywood stuff, I'm not as enamored with.
Ultimately, you're really looking at the tension that exists between a Hollywood actor and a Hollywood star. So when you transcend just being a Hollywood actor and become a Hollywood star, you are then suddenly entering into that Robert Downey Jr. sort of mode, where regardless of how downplayed a role may be, it's still hard to separate the actor out of the performance.
Exactly.
The thing is, I think people have got, you go into a Robert Downey Jr. performance and you're just kind of expecting to see the star. I do think that roles like Oppenheimer, I don't think that Oppenheimer was made stronger by Robert Downey Jr. being cast in that. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I do think the sympathizer is made stronger by Robert Downey Jr. being cast in this. The reason for because you watch this and you kind of do want a big, boisterous, loud performance in here and something which really stands out because nobody else in this cast is known. This is something where, I think there's a strong danger with this drama of getting a number of viewers who don't really have something to just hook into immediately. Okay, and you kind of need a little bit of a hook with this one. I think Robert Downey Jr. is that hook, and he provides and he delivers, and that's good, but not to the detriment of the rest of it. I watched Oppenheimer and I couldn't stop thinking about Robert Downey Jr. being Robert Downey Jr. And even though he was doing some capital A acting in that, I still couldn't really stop seeing him as a star.
Yeah. Yep. Totally agree. Well said. All right. So it's called The Sympathizer. It's on Max if you're one of our international listeners. Where is it screening in Australia?
That would be on Binge. And also it's on regular HBO in the US as well. It's a proper HBO series.
All right. Good to know. Finally, we get to the film that everybody, well, sort of everybody in our circle is kind of talking about. It's called Late Night with the Devil.
You're meddling with things you don't understand.
Whoa! Now, as you know, here on Night Owls, we think it's very important to keep an open mind. Please welcome Dr. June Ross Mitchell and Lily, the young subject of the book, Conversations with the Devil.
I really don't think it's a good idea, Jack. She's becoming more unpredictable.
That's a good thing. That's why we still do what? TV.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned for a live television first.
Late Night in the with the Devil is from two Australian brothers, Cameron and Colin Cairns, who have taken as their starting point for this, their inspiration for this, a certain Australian late night talk show host called Don Lane, who all of us are familiar with, if not being old enough like me to have remembered it. They certainly know him as one of the legends of Australian television. He is brought back to life in a certain way by the great David Dasmalchian, who in this movie plays Jack Delroy, a late night talk show host, who has a fondness for the supernatural. We found early in the film that he is involved with some Southern Californian types who go off into the forest late at night and chant and conjure and do all those sort of things. Many, many years ago, I digress away from the Don Lane story. Don Lane had on his show a gentleman called James Randi. James Randi was a skeptic and went about disproving a lot of the things that Don Lane had interest in, the supernatural, the paranormal. Don Lane would often have on the show Doris Stokes, who was a British clairvoyant. He would have on the show Uri Geller, who was the famous delusionist who could claim to bend spoons with his mind. And in one very famous confrontation, James Randi and Don Lane almost came to blows on the set of during the taping of one of the Don Lane shows. So Late Night with the Devil takes as its starting point, this tension. Jack Delroy is having ratings problems. During a sweep season, he decides to have on the show June Ross Mitchell, played by Laura Gordon, who brings with her a young woman called Lily, played by Ingrid Torelli, who may be in touch with a demonic spirit. And they plan to, on the show, conjure this demonic spirit through Lily and broadcast it live as a bit of a sweep stunt, but also ignoring all the consequences and possibilities that could go wrong by doing such a thing. In the middle of all this is a character called Christo, played by Faisal Batsi, who is the James Randi type, who is the skeptic who wants to poo-poo all of this, and things go horribly wrong along the way. This film opens with a terrifically edited montage sequence that is absolutely from that old school type of documentary, something like Killing of America, where they go through these early, where they go through a whole lot of clips as to how the story is going to unfold and the main characters involved with the story. And in this case, it's voiced by the great Michael Ironside. So it's got this great sort of extended opening montage sequence. And then you get into this beautifully recreated 70s late night television talk show set with an audience, with the crew, with the band, and the voice on the side, the sidekick, Gus, played by Rhys O'Terry. And you've got this wonderful setup that then goes very, very dark when horrible things start to happen, when the spirit is conjured, when the demon starts to manifest through Lily. It's all shot and all sort of and taken as a found footage type film. This is footage that has been found and resurrected for the sake of this sort of faux documentary. David Dasmalchian, who we all know from Suicide Squad and from Oppenheimer, the previously mentioned Oppenheimer, he is great as Jack Delroy. I had a lot of fun with this. The premise doesn't quite hold up. The found footage construct kind of falls apart a little bit when some of the behind-the-scenes footage is captured. That wouldn't have really happened back in those days. But the fun I had with just seeing the period recreated, the very wild and crazy payout at the end of the film, plus the great acting along the way, I think the Cairns brothers have made a really, really terrific and original little horror film.
Yeah, so I saw this one a couple of weeks ago. I was fairly enthused about seeing it as a late-night TV enthusiast. I really think this is a really fucking stupid film. I really didn't care for it. The further I get away from it, the more I really hate this film. Okay, so
wow.
There's a couple of things. So my general sort of non-Dan Barrett's reason that I didn't care for the film is that we talk about it being a found footage movie. If it's going to be a found footage movie, then it needs to be a found footage movie. This violates the found footage-ness of it almost repeatedly throughout the film from littlest, like, they try to justify it at the very beginning with a statement which says that the footage that you're seeing is a compile of footage that we're seeing from the broadcast, as well as some behind-the-scenes footage that's also been recorded. But the behind-the-scenes footage just looks like the exact same footage as the TV broadcast. There's no change in video quality by any means. There's no, it doesn't seem like it's security footage, but also it's the late 70s. So why are the backdoor passages around the sets being recorded in this way? Like, why does the audio quality never really shift? Like, there's no visual cues at all to suggest that we're seeing different types of video footage here. Okay, it doesn't change like aspect ratios. Like, there's just nothing. And that's really, really frustrating. And then you get to the point where this, what we're seeing is all taking place sort of within his mind. How are we seeing this as a found footage movie? It makes absolutely zero sense. If they stuck to the integrity of the found footage concept, you could have done something really, really cool here. But instead, it's just kind of really dumb. But from a Dan Barrett just getting annoyed perspective, there's no late night show that operated in US that's anything like this. The form and function of the program that they're watching here is a US daytime TV talk show. Okay, it's not night, like, it's not a late night show by any means. There's no comparison for it. And so you're watching and it's like, well, you've violated the found footage element. And then also you haven't bothered doing any research to make this feel like a show that may have actually existed. So where's the pleasure in this? And I just wasn't finding it.
Yes, they set it in America and it's an American star and American people across the board. The actual set, which looks a little bit like Blankety Blanks more than any talk show, to be honest, but the two chair setup without the desk, which I think you're referring to, that sort of standard American talk, late night talk show sort of thing, the chairs that they use in this is much more Don Lane. So they're taking it from that perspective and that point of view.
If you look at the set framework, it's set up the same way a lot of daytime shows worked. So this is probably a bit more... why can't I think of his name? Merv Griffin show than it is any of the late night shows.
Or Mike Walsh here in Australia.
And the thing is, you introduced it talking about the Don Lane connections. If this had been a film where they'd set a behind the scenes of a Don Lane in Australia, like, I don't think it's really taken away. Okay, like, you could have just done that. But instead, by setting in the US, there's an entirely different framework that they're working within, and it doesn't abide by that framework.
I get why that annoys you. I don't think that detracts from the actual film at all. But I understand. Look, and I do agree with you that setting it up as a found footage thing and introducing that whole footage taken from the forest when they went out and chanted for the demons and all that sort of stuff, that's kind of a long bow to pull. And you either sort of give the film the benefit of the doubt and go with that, and you're not the first critic I've spoken to that says the whole found footage thing and the way it's all cut together doesn't really make sense. I'm going to err on the side of, no, it doesn't, but I still really found this entertaining and energetic and original as a film, and that was enough to cut those moments some slack, whereas you kind of went the other way and say, no, it wasn't enough. And so I get that. I've heard that before, but I think there's enough in there, and the ending was so much fun and so sort of visually interesting to show that the film worked.
Look, it wasn't fun. I think the film had just well and truly violated itself so many times by the time it reached that end bit. Like, it wasn't earned, and it was weirdly telegraphed what was going on with it as well. Like, I was incredibly frustrated. I was polite and didn't groan that much with my friend who'd invited me along to go and see that, but I kept it all to myself. But yeah, I really just got frustrated by this terrible, terrible movie.
It's called Late Night with the Devil. It is in pretty wide release. They've got high hopes for this one. It's gone into most of the major chains, and on the back of a fair bit of buzz out of the US ahead of its release on Shudder over there. Maybe it'll be that rare sort of Australian horror films that does okay at the box office. Here's hoping. It's called Late Night with the Devil in cinemas now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
last week on the show, Simon did a very lengthy rant talking about film critics not being shown any due respect. And it's like, whatever, Simon. Okay, that's all very perfectly fine and well. I guess you've got your concerns. But anyway, in the spirit of throwing Simon a bone, I thought, yeah, let's celebrate critics. So look, we've all got our favorite critics. The best known is probably, in terms of like film criticism, like the best known critics to mainstream people is probably Siskel and Ebert. They hosted a syndicated film show in the US called At the Movies for about 14 years. Australia, we had our own At the Movies, just ripped off the whole thing. We got the reviewing duo of the seemingly thumbless David Stratton and Margaret Pomeranz. And of course, the less said about their coming attractions critic Jay Sherman, the better. But the question is, who do Simon and I rate? They don't have to be critics who've been on TV, like just critics across the board. They could be TV critics. Sure. They could be movie critics. Maybe we'll talk about food critics. Who knows where this conversation's going, but who are the critics worth paying attention to? So Simon, I thought this week we can both come to this. Just name a couple of our favorite critics, why we like them, and maybe we just engender a bit of a conversation about what it is about these critics we like and why we think that's important as a voice of like within criticism.
I think that's a great idea. I think critics should be given their due. Some of them, the very good ones.
No, Simon, let's not overrate things too much. They don't need that much due.
They do need their due. The very best critics offer incredible insight into the art form, whether it's film or television or restaurants or whatever. So, all right, I'm going to kick things off. And this is going to be, the first one is takes me right back to when I absolutely first started falling in love with the movies, which was the late 70s. I'd have been maybe 10, 11 years old, something like that. And the only source of film writing I had at that stage was the daily newspapers, The Sun, The Telegraph, The Herald, of course. And there was a wave here in Sydney, at least, and there was a whole generation of Australian critics, people like Bev Tivy, who the late, great Bev Tivy, who was fortunate enough to have met on a couple of occasions before she passed, the wonderful Tina Kaufman wrote back in those days. My favourite at the time was a gentleman named John Hanrahan. Now, some will remember John from his Channel 7 sort of interstitial reviews and interview shows. He had a huge history across the entertainment industry. He was the Hollywood Reporter's Australian editor, the president of the Film Critics Association, Critics Circle Association from 97 to 2000, wrote for The Sun, covered television and radio and music and theatre productions all over Australia, covered a whole bunch of Cannes film festivals. He wrote the first biography on actor Mel Gibson as well back in the day. He has put all his television reviews and interviews up on his new YouTube channel, just called John Hanrahan's Movie Star Interviews. And to see and hear these actors and the way he talks to them back in the day, he's that sort of, I have a little bit of an issue with entertainment reporter / film critic, because that can blur, and very often you're asked to review the films you're also getting an interview for, and that can impinge the integrity of your review and those sort of things. Hanrahan wasn't afraid to speak openly about what he thought about films, both as a critic and as an interviewer, and that was really, really interesting to me. So I'm going to go right back to John Hanrahan, who's still with us and still doing great work and a very successful businessman as well. But he was in that first wave of reviewers that I found really informative and have a huge amount of respect for.
Yeah, look, I don't think that one can really get away from the idea that a role as a critic blends into other elements of work around sort of screen culture. So often if you're a critic, you're doing interviews with talent, you may be doing some commentary and analysis about the industry. Like there's all sorts of various areas depending on what sort of critic you are and where you're sort of coming from that, you know, sort of lends into various things. So I just don't think that could be escaped. There's no purity when it comes to film criticism or TV criticism, and probably not restaurant criticism as well, I would presume. But yeah, I don't know. I never really sort of think about that too much, because I just think the reality is you just can't, you know, film criticism shouldn't be a purity contest. Let me sort of kick off with someone that I probably think is my favorite critic of the moment. And I think when it comes to film criticism, there's I'm probably looking for something slightly different than what I think you're after, Simon, when we're going through it. And this is just a, I guess, personal style a little bit, but also I guess maybe just sort of where I see the need and function of a critic existing, where I think maybe I'm a little bit more earthy in what I'm looking for from a critic. I'm not necessarily after an analysis of, you know, this performance was amazing, because as far as I'm concerned, a critic's actually not the best person who's equipped to be able to say that an acting performance was amazing, because they're not an actor. Okay. They're probably, I mean, speaking broadly, I'm sure there's some critics that have been actors and have gone through acting school, but broadly a critic is being asked to evaluate a whole bunch of things, which they're not actually credited to be able to adequately offer analysis on, but they can offer some insights and thoughts about how something made them feel, how they reacted to something, and whether from their perspective they saw something as a strong performance or not. But you always have to go into that with just a little bit of an understanding of, yes, it's a great performance from a schmo who doesn't necessarily know better, but if you understand technique a little bit more, you may actually find it's not that strong a performance. So there are some caveats involved in what they're doing. I prefer a critic to be not necessarily offering their verdict on something as much as those that start a conversation about what's taking place within the confines of a TV series or a film. So with that in mind, the critic that I probably enjoy the most at the moment is Lucy Mangan, who's a critic for The Guardian. She is very much a Simon Foster style critic, where she comes at things very much from, oh, this is a magnificent performance, whatever. But also she comes at it a little bit more from a Dan Barrett perspective as well, where she looks at his conversation starters, throws in elements from her own life, her own perspective, and really sort of just brings that to the fore in every writing she does. What I like about her most is that, one, I think she does bring that sort of very human, realistic perspective to it, but also I just really like her taste. Anytime that I read a review and she says that she likes something, I will always track that down, because I know that if she likes it, I'll probably like it. And to me, that's the form of the critic. You can't look at critics as being like an overall, oh, the critics hated it, so therefore it's bad. What you need to do as a person is find the critics that work for you and the people whose taste and vibe you generally sort of find credit in. And for me, it's Lucy Mangan. She's the one that is kind of just the my personal spirit animal. Okay, but she's not going to be for everyone either.
The next critic that I'm going to choose comes from a generation of critics that when I was in my early 20s, or maybe sort of starting at 20 going onwards, long-form film criticism was still a thing. And magazines like Premiere and Film Comment, and the trades like Variety, specifically for me, but also The Hollywood Reporter, of course, they offered long-form film criticism that I just swallowed up, just loved to read. People like Todd McCarthy wrote for Variety, and he's one of the most respected sort of trade film reviewer still out there. Stephen Ribello wrote for a great magazine called Movie Line. Glenn Kenny wrote for Premiere as well. Peter de Bruges was a writer who has come to the fore in recent times. He's the chief film critic at Variety magazine. It's a title that he shares with this man, and he's going to be my next on the list. It's called, his name is Owen Gleiberman. He's been with Variety since May 2016, authored a book which I guess I binge read, is the best way to call it, called Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies, which was sort of his formative years as a music critic and then a film critic and a social commentator. And it was a pretty amazing book to read, because it very much spoke in the voice I was speaking in. His film reviews for Variety speak to there's a certain personal story that he injects into each review that gives his reviews a not so much a first person perspective, but a real sort of human way of talking, and a real sort of you may not agree with this, or you may have a different view to this, but this is kind of who I am as a person and what this film meant to me in that regard. And he has a great knowledge of cinema and cinema history and the industry as well. So Gleiberman, being from that great body of film writers, McCarthy and Ribello and Kenny is the man that I go to read reviews for at the moment.
Yeah. Gleiberman, I think it was like former Entertainment Weekly. I think that might be right.
Yeah, he was with Entertainment Weekly for ages, 1990 yeah. until 2014, and his book gives a recount of what an ugly sort of separation that was in the end. It had a bit of a Leno Letterman sort of thing going on there behind the scenes, and it was a really terrific read. So, but he's bounced back, and obviously as chief film critic Variety, that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, sorry, I just got distracted by something. Simon, sorry, Gleiberman, just thinking about him. He's a critic where I really appreciate some of the reviews I read, and then he just really frustrates me from other perspectives. But, like, that's fine. Like, not every critic needs to be agreed with all the time. I think it's important to take a number of perspectives on board and sort of, you know, just think about it. Because it's really just opinion and perspective. Like, there's no ultimate truth being issued by any of these people. Two critics, I just want to lump my other two in just as part of the same conversation. Matt Zoller-Seitz, who I really quite like, and also Alan Sepinwall. Now, both of them aren't necessarily critics where I tend to agree with a lot that either of them sort of come to, especially Sepinwall. But I kind of like the approach both of them have taken, and they've both very much sort of come up of an age of the internet. So they've both sort of been a little bit maybe sort of scrappier in their approach, and it might just be they're both just generally sort of scrappy people, but I just kind of feel as though they are critics who nothing was necessarily handed to them as much as they've been making a space for themselves and have found themselves in reputable publications and unreputable publications. And while both of them have worked together as well, there's Matt Zoller-Seitz written this great sort of Mad Men book that I like, but the two of them work together on a Sopranos book, which is exceptional. I really just appreciate like their on the ground sort of sleeves up approach to all of this. But I wanted to talk about Sepinwall for a moment.
Zoller-Seitz is with Roger Ebert at the moment, isn't he? Isn't he writing for Ebert.com?
Yeah, he's been working for Ebert.com for years, I think, just as passed away. He was asked to become like the managing editor of it or something. So I don't know what his relationship is with these days, but he was definitely fairly important on that site sort of back in the day. He's a pretty well-respected guy just across the board. But I was particularly wanting to talk about Sepinwall in this one, only because I feel as though Sepinwall is both the beneficiary of coming up at an age where TV recaps were a really big thing and providing analysis on the fly. So the first thing you'd do after an episode of Lost had gone to air is you'd see what Sepinwall had to say about it, because he was just kind of one of the leading voices to read at the time. And so he was very much there for that episodics. But then when TV started moving more towards a binge mode of distribution, he just became a little bit less integral. Okay, and like, you know, he certainly has valuable insights to offer, even if I don't necessarily agree with him, I still like to know what he has to say. But he just kind of doesn't seem to be a vital voice in that space anymore. And Zoller-Seitz was also doing some sort of recappy type work sort of along the way, and I think he's fallen victim to it a little bit. But he's also carved out a bit more of a space of just being a sort of a deeper thinker about culture broadly, but then also shows with like a little bit more distance than Sepinwall, who is all about that immediate reaction. Okay, and as soon as he can't immediately react to this TV, suddenly he doesn't really quite have that voice, and it doesn't help him that he's now at Rolling Stone where there's a paywall involved. It sort of seems as though unless you're willing to pay for Rolling Stone, there's just such a separation between what Sepinwall was offering his audience, and the relationship between him and the online audience was such a crucial part of the value of him that as soon as he took that away as well, like, it's just kind of, it seems like a critic who's just scratching around at the moment trying to find where he belongs nowadays. And I just find that interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that is interesting. All right, well, let's wrap this up. And this is where I was interested in your comments at the top there when you mentioned your first reviewer. And you said that you like to have a reviewer who you can kind of trust with a point of view, who, you know, if you like their thing, if they like a thing, you're going to like a thing, and you're sure you want to see it and stuff like that. So that's interesting, because my last one is a gentleman who is one of the most controversial film critics doing the rounds at the moment, and who often takes very specific points of view that some detractors will call ultra conservative or very right wing.
Simon, we don't need to talk about me in this. Like, I know I'm one of your favorites, but, you know, whatever.
It's true. That gentleman is a man called Armand White. Now, He's an American film and music critic who writes for the National Review and Out paper. And he was previously the editor of City Arts and the lead film critic for New York Press, which was an alternative weekly. Wrote for the City Sun. He's just published a book, or just in the last year or so, called Make Spielberg Great Again, the Steven Spielberg comments. He and I rarely agree on the politics of a film, but he does genuinely write really compelling and interesting reviews from an entirely different perspective to me. And I think it's really, really important to hear this other point of view on a film, to broaden one's mind as to the film. I'm really passionate about not being caught in the bubble of your own opinions, of your own self, sort of what you believe in the world, and only sort of reinforcing that with those around you, that by surrounding yourself with people who have the same opinion. Armand White and I do not have the same opinion on most things, but his criticisms and his writings are compelling to read, and certainly put forward a different point of view that helps me understand that different point of view. Not agree with it, not my head along to it. More often I'm shaking my head, but they are legitimate points of view from a very good writer and someone who can look at art, specifically in films in general, from an entirely different perspective. He writes things like, no movie is ahead of its time, just ahead of the cultural gatekeepers, which is the sort of thing that can fire people up, and in doing so can create a whole lot of tension. But that tension is good. That's the kind of discussion you need to have when it comes to discussing art, and it shouldn't be poo-pooed even if you don't agree with it. So I like Armand White's writings, and he can be found. It's not hard to find. Google Armand White and you'll get some idea of how strongly he is viewed on the internet. So that's my three.
Yeah, I was just reading a feature about him on a website called Pure Shit Cinema.
All you got to do is read it. See, this is why occasionally when I'm sitting at home and just channel surfing, I'll watch 20 minutes of Fox News, only because I'm not going to live in a bubble where I criticize it and then and someone will say, oh, yeah, how much do you watch? And I say, well, I never watch it. And I'm like, well, you've got to try to have some understanding of what they're saying and what they're doing as a firsthand experience rather than it infuriates me, and I don't get more than half an hour into most Fox News channels. And sometimes I'll heave out a big sigh when I get to the end of an Armand White film review. But, you know, I'm getting a different perspective, and I think that's important.
Yeah, no, look, I actually agree with that entirely. So, I mean, I'll watch the occasional bit of Fox News for that same perspective. And then also I'll mix that in with a little bit of other conservative podcasts and News Nation and all that sort of, just awful, awful TV. But you kind of need to know what other people are saying. You need to hear perspectives outside of your own circle. So, yeah. Certainly agree.
Exactly right.
Simon, I think it's time to move on with the rest of the podcast.
One of my favorite parts of the podcast is What Else Have You Been Watching? Where I get to ask Dan Barrett. Dan Barrett, what else have you been watching?
Curb Your Enthusiasm. So, Seinfeld.
I know of it.
Did I say Seinfeld then? Simon. Sorry, that's Seinfeld brain. Simon Foster, who is not the American stand-up comedian named Jerry Seinfeld. Simon Foster, when I cook dinner, my favorite thing to do is I get my iPad, I open it up, I load up the app, I start streaming a show called Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I watch that while I cook. I do that for two
Interesting.
Reasons.
Interesting.
And I've been doing this for years. Okay, look, I do it for two reasons.
I couldn't do that.
One, it's a very funny, entertaining program, okay? But two, there's a thing with Curb Your Enthusiasm where you don't actually need to watch the show from beginning to end in one sitting. You could watch the first, 10 minutes of an episode, okay, and then just come back to it, a few days later and watch the second half, and you're still going to have a perfectly entertaining experience with it.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know, but there's just something where there's suddenly a narrative to every episode. So don't feel that I'm not saying that, but there's just something where every scene on that is just so standalone. Okay. And always
that's true.
almost tells its own story within every short scene. That, you know, it works. And there's no short scenes on Curb either. Like, every scene runs a couple of minutes. Like, it's an opportunity for some proper improv to be brought to the screen. Mm. So, it's great for cooking because you can kind of, you know, you watch Curb for as long as it takes to cook the meal. Okay, and then it's done and you feel perfectly happy pressing pause because, you know, we come back to it and just be, you know, picking up
that
experience again.
That's quite a skill.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I can't be distracted by things in my ears or noise in the background when I'm cooking. What about the big knives and the temperatures and all that sort of stuff? I'm very much I need to have sole focus on what I'm doing. So that's quite a skill, Dan Barrett. You surprise me no end by that admittance.
If I'm watching the anger contained in an episode of Cobra Enthusiasm, I need a knife in my hand. It's just important. It's part of the process.
Good.
I've been doing that for years, and I had a very awkward situation where the new season of Curb came back. It's very last, and I was like two-thirds of the way through the series. I was just starting season 10 when they came back, because they were making the show up until like 2012, 13, I think, and then took a hiatus until 2020, and it came back. So ostensibly, Larry David was finished with the show, and then they just kept on asking him, are you coming back? And he started thinking, oh, I kind of want to come back and do some more. So he came back and did some more. Sure. The show had finished like years and years ago. But I was like midway through, and I thought, well, no, I'm going to like finish out the run of the show, and then I'll just catch up to where we're at with the season. But obviously, I didn't cook enough dinners during like the last month and a half because I just fell behind. And so, like, I finally caught up, but I had like nine episodes.
That's the woman's job, Dan. That's the woman's job.
Okay, sorry. Okay. But anyway, I'm not going there. But so I ended up having to like binge watch this entire last season of Curb Your Enthusiasm all over the course of 3 days just to catch up with it. So I could watch the last episode on that final day, which is important to me because I've spent so much of my life now watching Curb Your Enthusiasm. I mean, this is a show that premiered back in 2000 and I've been watching it like this entire time.
Wow.
Okay. Like eagerly looking forward to it. So seeing the final episode, big moment for me. I got to say, I loved it. TV shows aren't meant to end is probably the big thing to realize going into any series. So a final episode is always built to be a statement about the program that was rather than necessarily finishing off a narrative. And anyone who's looking for a narrative closure with a TV show finale is just approaching it wrong because, you know, the narrative's never going to be a satisfactory conclusion and nor will it feel like a defining statement about the show that you've been watching. The best things are always where it ends with some sort of a statement as to this is how we've spent our time together. Like, what did you think? Okay. And the final statement of this show was that the show you've been watching has been about one thematic idea the entire time, which is that Larry David, the star of the show, has never learned a single lesson. And as you watch that final episode of Seinfeld, of Curb Your Enthusiasm, it just has all these echoes to the final episode of Seinfeld, which is, as far as the public's concerned, the one thing that Larry David just truly just messed up in his life.
Okay, got wrong. So, yeah, that's true. Okay, that's an interesting perspective.
So as he finishes his final program, it's kind of a judgment on Larry David. Did he learn the lessons of what he did with the Seinfeld finale, or is he going to screw this up as well? And if the entire thematic idea of Curb Your Enthusiasm has been he's never learned his lesson, how does the show deal with that? And the final episode deals with it by him not learning his lesson. He plays out the thing just like the final episode of Seinfeld did, but in a Curb Your Enthusiasm vibe, okay, which is not that far removed. And it just plays out the exact same way. So you reach the very end of the episode where, much like at the end of Seinfeld, Larry David is sentenced to a year prison and he's sitting there in a cell by himself. And much like at the end of Seinfeld where they get held up with talking about like the distance between buttons on a shirt, and that some buttons are just too high on a shirt and whatnot, which is a conversation from the very first episode of Seinfeld. Larry David's seen in his cell looking down at his pants and they start tensing up, much like in one of the very earliest episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm, where he's concerned about a pants tent. So it's him not learning any lessons. But the show ends with Jerry Seinfeld, who'd been in the final episode of Curb, popping his head in saying, hey, Larry, it's okay. You can come out of prison and we don't need to go and sort of walk on him out. But it's basically Jerry Seinfeld who came to Larry's defense at the end, got him out of prison. Okay, so Larry did not learn anything through the entire course of the show, although the last episode does play things out slightly different to that Seinfeld episode. So you're left with a question. Did Larry David, the artist, learn anything through life, or is it just the character that ever learned anything? And that's kind of the fun dichotomy of it all.
He's never not an great with structure and great with building these episodes around this greater structure of, in terms of the narrative. And I think that's what he's done there. And that's it's a brilliant piece of sort of understanding you've given us into the final episode, of which I've seen most of. I haven't quite seen the end of it yet. And I guess because it came out right when I had my first child, I didn't have the time or didn't have the inclination to watch the Larry David Curb Your Enthusiasm back when it first came out. So I've only seen like maybe a dozen episodes over the whole year. Very funny, love watching it, just never been my thing. But I've got to say the opening sequence in this finale on the plane is very, very funny and is a classic bit of Larry David Curb Your Enthusiasm comedy. So I guess was there enough good things in the 12th season to warrant that season? Very often, you know, you're thinking of The X-Files, you're thinking of some of these shows that come back, you know, very soon you realise that, well, there wasn't enough on the table there to really make this worthwhile. Do you think that season 12 of Curb Your Enthusiasm is a good thing?
Look, I mean, The X-Files went off the rails, like, you know, season 5 or 6. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Look, I would definitely say that the last couple of episodes of the season, I think, are fantastic. There's an episode where Larry David is hung up and calling people the captain. Look, there's certainly things towards the end of that, which, you know, I had a lot of joy with. But, like, it's not a great season. But also, I'd say season 11 had a few, like, great moments and then, like, a few duds along the way. And, like, a Curb Your Enthusiasm dud episode is still better than most things on TV. But is it of the standard? I'm not too sure. And part of the challenge is season 10 of the program, the second season after they came back, the Mocha Joe season is the one. Like, it is such a amazing season of television with so many great episodes in there that I think it was just hard for the show to live up to some of the heights that it really offered that year.
The first witness to take the stand in the finale too, Mocha Joe. Okay. What else have I been watching? I'm glad you asked. Also in cinemas this week is an animated film called Robot Dreams. It was nominated for the Best Animated Film Oscar at this year's Oscar ceremony. It tells the story set in this sort of alternate reality where a little bit like Zootopia, actually, the Disney film where animals live in a late 80s New York City. One of them, Dog, is a very lonely individual, decides to get a robot friend that he orders and constructs in his brownstone apartment. They become friends, but they become separated, and it's the two different journeys that these individuals take while always being consumed by the memories of each other that makes for a very sweet, sometimes very sad, beautifully rendered in terms of animation story from director Pablo Berger, who a few years back made a film called Blonde Konyevs, which was a sort of a black and white gothic retelling of Cinderella. So he loves sort of the fairy tale elements in his storytelling, but does stuff that's very different with it. Loved Robot Dreams. Maybe not, although it very much looks kid-friendly. It does go to some dark places that might be a little bit too sad for kids, but there are moments that just absolutely soar as enjoyment reaches its peak throughout this. Great use of the song September in key moments to get the toe tapping and the heart swelling. So Robot Dreams is in limited release around Australia.
Yeah, so I've seen Robot Dreams, and I've got to come back to it because there were certainly elements that I really liked about it, but the one thing you didn't really mention is that this is a dialogue-free movie. And yes, for a film that's about depression and isolation and loneliness, the fact there's no dialogue, which is absolutely a choice made to emphasize that, I just kind of found that even the scenes where the robot was hanging around, with the dog hanging around with the robot, which was supposed to be fairly joyous, I don't know, I just kind of felt like just this overall, I don't know, just dark void that I was just facing into, which probably speaks to the quality of the movie I was watching. But at the same time, I just wasn't there for it at the time. So I'm going to have to come back. I'm going to have to be in a sunnier mood to watch that because things were getting bleak with me on that couch.
But what else have you been watching, Dan Barrett?
So, Simon, in the cinemas this week as well is the first... Well, I was going to ask you, the first Omen's playing in cinemas. How's that?
Yes. Okay, so we have with the first Omen one of those films that is an origin story, and by that I mean it takes place very much like the movie you and I disagree on, but Rogue One takes you right up to the beginning of the first Star Wars and New Hope stories. So does the first Omen. It tells of the birth of the Antichrist, as, who would become known as Damien, and the young American nun who goes to Rome to start her nunnery life, take her vows and give over her life to Christ, but who instead finds herself caught up in a narrative that may or may not sort of position her as the mother of the Antichrist, the return of the Antichrist. It's a beautiful-looking film. This is far and away more polished than I expected. It has a great sort of European feel and look to it. The actress has an unusual name, and I really want to get it right, Nell Tiger Free as the young nun, is she's terrific. The first half hour is almost plot point for plot point the same as the Sydney Sweeney film Immaculate, which is still in theatres. Very much the American nun heading to the nunnery in Rome, the convent, I should say, not the nunnery, and finding that things are going terribly. But then it goes off on its own path, and the ending is sort of that. I hate the term elevated horror because it suggests that some horror, you know, is of a lower standard. This is just a great bit of horror storytelling, a real sort of old school religious shocker that I absolutely lapped up. And I thought it was a terrific film.
Yeah. Something I saw which is streaming on your TV and your various other devices, Simon, is Scoop, the new film that's debuted on Netflix. So, look, this is the behind-the-scenes story of the Newsnight interview with Prince Andrew, where he's confronted about his association with Jeffrey Epstein. The first 20, 30, maybe even 40 minutes of this is fantastic. The problem is that the back end of the film just doesn't really have anything to say after it's sort of established all these characters. There's this framework of it, like essentially it's really sort of structured around the lady that's responsible for the booking of guests on this BBC interview program. And she's someone who is, at least as framed in this movie, quite a bit more populist in the way that she thinks about the relationship with the audience than some of the more sort of strict news people that are working on the program. So she doesn't really feel as though she sort of fits in with everyone, and there's definitely that tension. And that's probably the strongest element of the film, I thought. So I kind of wish they'd played around with that a little bit more. And while it informs the character, I don't think it informs the film as much as I think it is intending to from the outset. As you get further into the movie, it starts to replace like that tension with maybe just a bit more of a celebration of the fact that you've got three women in sort of key roles putting this into the world. So you got this talent booker who does find herself on the outs as the story sort of develops. But then you've also got the executive producer of the program, who's a woman, and then the host of the program, who's a woman as well. And it kind of becomes this sort of very empty feeling celebration of, oh, it's great that these women are in these sort of positions of power, but it doesn't really sort of interrogate them and move backwards and forwards with what's interesting about them, which is what's interesting about this woman and how she's sort of being squeezed out. Does she still have a future with Newsnight, even though she's delivered them like this amazing interview? Like, you don't really get a sense of any of that kind of thing. What does it mean for the executive producer to have like this tension existing on her staff? Is she someone of whom actually values that? Is she someone of whom feels that she's made a wrong choice with the person that she's hired to have such an antagonistic relationship with the rest of the people on the staff? Like, you don't get a feeling for any of that. And Gillian Anderson's kind of a bit of a nothing presence in as well as the host of the program. She's kind of just trotting out the Thatcher character she played in The Crown. For a season or so there. Like, I don't know. I really wanted to like this a lot more. And there's certainly a lot going for the first half of it, but it just doesn't back it up with anything for the back half.
That's interesting because I sort of went the other way. I know that you and I have kind of poo-pooed the preponderance of sort of modern history dramatizations here on the podcast previously, the retelling of things that have just been in the headlines. I thought this took a really interesting point of view from the terms of the Billy Piper character, Sam McAllister, who is the talent finder that you're talking about, who finds herself with kind of a connection to the palace, and is able to get in first and get the Prince Andrew interview for the Gillian Anderson character and for the Newsnight show. I thought there was plenty at stake that wasn't gender-based when you talk about those three women. I thought that Romola Garai's character, the sort of the head of the executive producer of Newsnight, and Gillian Anderson's host, and the Billy Piper character, all had legitimately individual issues that needed to be addressed that weren't just about gender or weren't just about the issues they were going through and the issues they were kind of symbolic of or representative of in the context of this story. That said,
now, see, Simon,
yes,
sorry,
there's a strong about this.
Sorry, can I just interrupt briefly? So I think that what you said is right, but it's very much, there's that tension with Billy Piper's character, which that is not about her gender at all. But there's a scene where she gets invited down to the set and she's there with the two other like important women on the program. And it's just the three of them on the set. And I think they even verbalize it at some point, which is, oh, you know, 10 years ago, they never would have, you know, this wouldn't have happened. Okay. And it's from that point in that the rest of the movie gets framed through that scene. Like that scene actually derails it all. So if they hadn't had that scene, I don't think I'd be reading as much into it as gender, but they put that on the table to set the table for what the rest of the film is. And so you can't view the rest of the film without seeing it through the prism of that scene. That's what it's there for.
Yeah, perhaps. I think there's also a role to be played by the character at the palace, Prince Andrew's press secretary, the woman who sort of allows and has faith in Andrew to be the to tell his own story and to clear his own name on air, and that sort of blind faith and blind sort of belief in the power of the monarchy and the power of them is also a really interesting point of view. And I guess if you're going to weigh in on the gender roles of those three women sort of coming after Andrew and coming after the interview, you've also got to look at her gender in that role as well, which is open to interpretation. We can't not mention that Rufus Sewell is terrific as Prince Andrew, barely recognizable under a lot of makeup, and just he has some very just he's such a buffoon in some of the stuff and some of the belief he has. And when the what is it with photoshopping in movies until it always looks terrible when they photoshopped the young Rufus Sewell into the picture with Virginia, the young 17-year-old, that famous photo that he was caught with his arm around her. I actually found this very entertaining, which I didn't expect to. I thought it was going to be a little bit sort of kind of like a spotlight sort of movie where it just sort of showed the machinations as to how they got the interview. I thought they were all really interesting sort of and entertaining characters as well as telling a good story.
Yeah, I mean, I found that first half incredibly entertaining, but after that, it just kind of lost steam. I just don't think it really had anything that it needed to present. So I just kind of wish they'd sort of reframed at the beginning. And you talked about the lady that was the head of comms for Prince Andrew. If the film had been a juxtaposition between what her agenda was versus what Billy Piper's agenda was, and you can still focus on their respective stories through that, I think that might have been a more interesting way to approach that. Because, I mean, obviously, once that happens, there's fallout. So we see the impacts on Billy Piper's character once she sort of gets squeezed out. We'd then see the impacts on the comms director. Okay, but you don't really quite get that. Like, once the interview happens, it kind of happens. And at a certain point, the film just becomes, oh, well, you know, they've set it up, so now's the interview. But I think the actual interview itself is the least interesting part of this.
Interesting week on What Else Have You Been Watching? There you go. That's an out. That didn't seem awkward at all. All right, roll into the quizzes.
Okay, let's do this.
Dan Barrett, we have come to the fun part of the show. I mean, it's all fun. We're having a good time, but this week in history and the birthday quiz are about to unfold. Let's go with this week in history. I'm going to be testing you with three significant dates. Cool. from the last century of film and television. Let's see if you can come up with what those dates represent. April 14, 1961. Which Eastern Bloc country has its first ever live television broadcast?
Look, I mean, I just kind of assumed that it was in one of those road movies like a Bing Crosby and Bob Hope thing.
Yeah, no, it wasn't in that. Look,
I'm not sure. What was it?
In an event televised live throughout the Soviet Union, Yuri Gagarin received a hero's welcome at the Vancouver airport, where he was greeted by Soviet dignitaries and cheered along a 16-kilometer route to Moscow's Red Square. So it was the celebration of Yuri Gagarin's space flight. So it was the Soviet Union.
Okay.
April 16, 2017, not that long ago, you were a young man back then, a world record was broken when how many Charlie Chaplin lookalikes, where do I get this stuff, gathered at the Charlie Chaplin Museum in Corsier de Vevey, Switzerland. How many Charlie Chaplins make for a gathering of Charlie Chaplins?
I mean, my understanding from physics is 4,632.
Jeez, you were so close. The answer is 662. They congregated at the Chaplin's World Museum to celebrate Chaplin's, what would have been Chaplin's 128th birthday.
Oh, this is the 2017 event. I was thinking 2019.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
There you go. That's the problem. Yeah. April 19, 1927, which actress is charged and found guilty, mind you, of, quote, obscenity and corrupting the morals of youth?
Simon Foster, please, if you're going to talk obscenity, like, obviously I'm going to know the answer. We're talking about Mae West.
No, it's Helen Hunt. It is Mae West. I apologize. As the star of a New York
1927.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Helen Hunt's problems came much later. As the star of a New York stage play entitled Sex, Mae West is sentenced to 10 days in prison and fined $500, but the resulting publicity absolutely launched her Hollywood career and she became the lady who said, can you do your best Mae West impersonation for us?
I'm not gonna. No, this is the internet's forever. I can't do it. No.
Come up and see me sometime. Nice. All right. Time for birthdays.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
All right. What have we got here? All right, Dan Barrett. Let's see if you can figure out exactly who all these birthday buddies are. April 14, 1940, the beautiful Julie Christie. April 14, 1925, the not quite so beautiful Rod Steiger. Then April 17, 1985, one Rooney Mara. And then going all the way back to 1935, April 19, the very funny Dudley Moore. Maybe my favorite comedian ever. He was born. Now, what could all these multi-generational actors have in common? It's all to do with a certain role that they've played. I'll give you that much, people. Any idea?
I didn't think it was a role. So, I mean, I was thinking at some stage they all had on-screen sex with Donald Sutherland, but I don't think that's right. Look, I'm going to throw this out there. I feel that Rooney Mara, I'm trying to like look into Rooney Mara right now, some of the films that just played, but Dudley Moore, I feel might be the... Like one here, have they all played alcoholics on screen?
No. I think probably Rooney Mara's most famous performance is your end point here. She worked with Australian director Garth Davis on something that might be the end point. Silence.
I mean, Nobody. Sorry, you say her most famous role, but I would have thought her most famous roles are either The Social Network or Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah, maybe. Certainly most successful, that would be those two, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about the Rooney Mara role suddenly right now. She's the my least favourite Mara.
Yeah, she's a very chilly screen presence, I think.
Okay, well, what's the answer? I'm obviously not getting this.
All right. Now, I'm
maybe
a couple of weeks past due. Yeah, that was her sister, yeah. So I'm a couple of weeks past due, and this maybe should have been the Easter weekend quiz, because they've all played significant roles in religious music, religious movies or biblical stories. Julie Christie provided the voice of Rachel in the stop-motion Christ story, The Miracle Worker. Rachel was the wife of Jacob, who gave birth to Joseph and Benjamin. April 14, Rod Steiger played Pontius Pilate in the blockbuster miniseries Jesus of Nazareth, and we all know who Pilate was. Rooney Mara played Mary Magdalene, in Garth Davis's Mary Magdalene. And Dudley Moore starred in the biblical comedy Holy Moses as Herschel, an Old Testament idol maker whose life and adventures parallel that of the more famous Moses, which came in the wake of Life of Brian. They were trying for the same sort of thing, and it wasn't as funny, but it's kind of a fun movie, Holy Moses, if you get a chance to see it. Dudley Moore had a very troubled Hollywood career. He had those big hits with Ten and Arthur, and then things kind of went off the rails a bit, but one of my favorite comedians of all time. So they all start in biblical stories. There you go, one for the Judeo-Christians out there.
I'm going to put it out there, that was the least fun birthday quiz that we've done today.
I'm not going to argue with that. It was a tough week. I actually had a lot of people to choose from. There was an Anya Taylor-Joy. There was just a whole bunch of birthday people this week, but I just couldn't find a link until a light came from above, Dan, and I received a message. Anyway, let's wrap this up.
All right, folks, sorry to end on this down note, but this has been Screen Watching. It's our, you know, look at the screen watching that we've done. If you like more of this, you can find us on, what are the social media channels we've got there, Simon?
Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast, on Threads and YouTube. You can find us at Screen Watching, or send us an email, screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. You can see some of my writings over on ScreenSpace, screen-space.net. And I know you've got a couple of wonderful outlets where you do your thing, Dan.
Oh, look, that's certainly outlets. Alwaysbewatching.com. It's a newsletter that receives, like, it goes straight to your inbox, your mail, your Google mail, your Yahoo mail, whatever mail you've got. Happens right there. I do like a weekly, daily write. Sorry, I forgot what I actually do, Simon. It's a newsletter that comes out each day with all the news stories related to TV, mostly streaming TV and broadcast TV, but a little bit with movies, a little bit with tech platforms like virtual reality. Or today I talked about a Japanese pop star who has disappointed people on her North American tour. That was interesting because she's a hologram. She's not a real person. But anyway.
I know. Where did you get that information from? Your sources are extraordinary, because I read that with interest. I'd never known of Miko, and I didn't expect to hear of Miko through you, but that's what you get with your Always Be Watching and Always Be Streaming newsletters.
Different
perspectives of the world of film and television.
But yeah, hit me up, alwaysbewatching.com. Sign up. It's free. You get it 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And then I do a bonus subscriber-only newsletter, which still has a fair bit of content for the free subscribers as well. And that one's called Always Be Streaming. And that's obviously on Friday afternoon.
And don't forget what we blabbered about at the start of the show all those hours ago, our new YouTube channel format, where you can see bite-sized grabs of the segments from this week's show. And a whole lot of other content as well. It's a good channel.
And I'm going to end by apologizing to people. This has been a 90-minute podcast, Simon. That's unacceptable. folks, it will not be long that next week. That's not going to happen. But we'll be back and talking about fewer things next week.
You know, it has gone long, but I do just want to read you the first
chapter
of the book.
Stop talking, Simon. Just end the podcast. End this podcast now. Simon, end it.
All right, we're done. Yeah, it's done. I'm finished. I'm out.
Say goodbye. Say goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody. Have a fun weekend. All the very best. Ronnie says hi.
Thank you very much for listening. In however many times, like, you probably listened to this over like 5 consecutive days, because it's too long. Folks, we'll be back next week with a shorter podcast.